Of things that I want to mention as we get started. One is I want to reiterate, I'm going to try and do this briefly. I want to reiterate what Justin said about the Tuesday afternoon kids program. Obviously something like that has limitless potential, but it also has like unlimited necessity. We can talk about the problems in our society and whatever, but you know there's a big difference between feedback and complaining. If you don't know the difference, it probably means you're complaining. And we complain a lot about our society, but we don't always have feedback. You know, we don't always have an answer or a proposal. You know, we don't have a suggestion. We just have complaints. You know, programs like this, one kid at a time. I mean. That's how your life got changed because Jesus touched you as an individual, you know, and this is an opportunity for us to touch individual kids. That's how the world gets changed. That's how that's done. It's the only way the world gets changed, you know, and how many thousands of people ate from Jesus's hand. Talk about having the crowd eating out of your hand. I mean, they literally ate from Jesus's hand, and yet there were about 120 people on which the Spirit fell on the day of Pentecost. You know, it is not the thousands eating out of your hand that changes the world. It's the people that you have time to actually spend time with and interact with and impact. So, you know, I would just like to say that, you know, there's a lot of you that for work and other reasons can't be a part of that. But I want you to know that probably right now as it's you know, in its initial stages, maybe one of the most important things that our church is working on. So I really want you to be in prayer for that. Again, read to your kids, single biggest indicator of future academic success and high ACT scores, read to your kids. If you don't have any kids, find somebody else's, all right? Be here on Tuesday nights and read to somebody else's kids. If you can't be here on Tuesday nights, again, donate children's books so I can read to your kids, all right? This stuff is important. And Principal Webster at the school will tell you that when it comes to like testing on literacy, it's the Dibble test. We are definitely an underperforming school district. So, like again, you can complain or you can have feedback. Like we have an opportunity to do something about something that is a known problem. And we have the opportunity to do it here where we can do it however we want and we can read to them books about, you know, the one who saves their soul. Just like to mention in consequence of that, so whatever you know, please support that in whatever way you see fit, whatever way you're able, because honestly, I don't know how many kids have to be there in a rural area like this before it's a pretty big deal, but it's a pretty big deal. Secondly, on the same point, remember what some of the people here are actually doing when you don't see them. I don't remember if we were going to or coming from the beach. It doesn't really matter. We were in the car, and that's about the only time you turn off your, like, parental instincts because you got them strapped down. All right? It's like the only time you can legally strap your kids down, you know? And, like, when they're asleep and you're asleep, you're still tuned up, right? Like, you hear them like that, which is why you have kids and never sleep again. You can hear them in a crowd. You know who it is. You know in the house when they're hollering to each other and when they're hollering at each other. Like you get pretty fine tuned in a hurry. You know it's sort of natural. You want to ensure the success of your like you know biological replication. You know so you get pretty tuned up pretty quick. So in the car is like the only time you're not really paying attention to them, and then they wonder why you don't answer them. You know, and we're sitting there in the car, and all of a sudden we hear in this monotone cadence, which is how you teach little kids things, you know. You teach them in this cadence, you know. So imagine this. I don't know if your kids did this, but I bet you I didn't. And the Lord said to Abram, go to the land I will show you. And they continued, all right, with this. And I looked at her and she looked at me. And she's like, did you teach him that? I'm like, mm-mm. No, that's Miss Debbie and Miss Heifer. All right? And I'm like, holy cow. So we, you know, I teach them, like, we keep our promises. We do what we say. You know, sometimes your kids are squabbling. You're like, hey, figure it out. You guys make a deal. Make a deal with each other where you're both happy with the deal. And then one of them, like, you know, will sneakily start to break the deal, and the other one will freak out. You're breaking your deal. You know, of course, they do that just loud enough for me to hear, you know. It's like sneaky tattling, you know. We don't break our deals. Like, you do what you say because God keeps his promises, all right? So, like, for instance, and I will make you a blessing, and I will make of you a great nation, you know. And they're reciting the Abrahamic covenant in the back of the car, all right? We got some really gifted people here, all right? Do not lose your appreciation for the people that make this thing function, all right? Obviously, children's ministry is always one that stands out to me because I got little kids. But a lot of you do too, and a lot of you that don't, someday you will, all right? And if you're not raising them here, I hope you're raising them in a church where they learn to recite the Abrahamic covenant on road trips, because that is exactly the way it ought to be, all right? That's not like John 3:16. Like, it's your problem to teach your kids John 3:16, you know? But then you bring them to Sunday school and they learn the Abrahamic covenant from memory. Like, this is pretty much the real deal, folks. So when it comes to children's ministry here, we are not messing around, all right? We are not messing around. And there are a lot of churches who will take any volunteer for children's ministry, and we will too. But it's because they just need those slots filled. And I'm just really thankful that we have people who are willing to do that who also seem to have a clue what they're doing. And we are just incredibly privileged. When we left Nichols to come here, we were a little bit afraid of what it might be like for our kids because the Sunday school teacher they had at Nichols was incredible. You know, she had done a lot of special education, and she had done a lot of different things, and she was awesome with kids. And so at the hymn sing last week, we were able to tell her, hey, guess what? You'll never believe this. You'll never believe what the kids were reciting in the car. You know, we got them in good hands, Nancy, you know. So I appreciate you guys an awful lot, all of you that are involved in children and youth ministry. I feel privileged to be involved with the youth group, to be at the Tuesday afternoon thing. I think it's great. I think we do a lot of great things here, and I just want to bring that to your attention and kind of remark on how important it is, because I don't want you to lose sight of, you know, being involved in those things any way that you can. And I appreciate all of you who are, and I appreciate the opportunity to be involved in those things myself. It was hilarious. I was third string for the young kids' Sunday school class. You never know how it's going to go when you have your own kids in class, you know. And so I've taught that class here one time, and it was really fun because they tell you what's supposed to happen next because you don't know, you know. And it was good. I'm sitting down. Of course, when you sit down, you're sitting like way down at the table, you know. And I'm like, if they get to sit down, I'm going to sit down, which is what I'm doing now. You know, I'm sitting way down at the table. I'm looking at them sort of at their eye level, which is always a weird feeling. And they said, next we have snacks. And I'm like, why am I not in this class? Like, and I said, there's snacks. I'm like, and I looked at Emily Nelson and I said, don't tell me that means I got to get up out of this chair. You know, because you're a long way down sitting in one of those chairs, you know. And she says, no, because I can reach them. I'm like, yes. All right. And at the end, she says to me, I think the kids liked you. And I looked at her, I'm like, the kids, who are you? You know, she says, well, I'm one of them, you know. And so I kind of took that as a compliment. Like, it is an awesome privilege to be involved in shaping young hearts so that they know Jesus, they love Jesus, and they're therefore better equipped to be good people, you know, and good citizens and love others. It's just an incredible, incredible privilege. And so all of you that are involved in that, I hope you don't lose sight of the privilege that it is. And all of you who are not involved in that, I hope you don't lose sight of the gratitude that we should have for the people who are in the thick of it with our kids. Speaking of the Nelsons, that moves me on to the next thing I wanted to say. Got this card this week. We are just about settled into our rental home and our routine of church life. We live out of town up on a hill with lots of yard to run and play in. We've had a few folks over for dinner, and the church has been kind to bring us meals. Our church services are very upbeat, and I don't get to lead singing for now, but I'm really enjoying preaching each Sunday. I think of you often, and thank God for making me part of the Orwell Bible Church family. God bless you all, Pastor Dave and family. So just want to read that to you, let you know that it sounds like, at least in greeting card format, sounds like they're happy. That's always the short version. But and that's another thing I'd like to thank you all for making them welcome. I think that we serve them in a lot of ways, and I'm privileged that I'm proud of us for having had that opportunity and taking it. And I feel like it was a real privilege and a real blessing for us. Obviously, they came here under, you know, pretty hard circumstances, and I can tell you that when you're a new pastor trying to figure out which end is up, there is nobody that has your back quite like a pastor who himself is out of favor. So for me, that relationship with Dave, I'm really glad that you took the Nelsons in because I think I needed Dave and didn't know it. So continue in prayer for them and their ministry and their life. Shoot, there's enough to pray for. 6 kids. All right. So moving on to Matthew chapter 14. We're gonna finish the chapter today. Immediately, this is after the feeding of the 5,000, immediately Jesus made his disciples get into the boat and go before him to the other side, while he sent the multitudes away. And when he had sent the multitudes away, he went up on the mountain by himself to pray. Now when evening came, he was alone there. Excuse me. But the boat was now in the middle of the water, tossed by the waves, for the wind was contrary. Now in the fourth watch of the night, Jesus went to them, walking on the sea. When the disciples saw him walking on the sea, they were troubled, saying, "It's a ghost," and they cried out for fear. But immediately Jesus spoke to them, saying, "Be of good cheer, it is I, do not be afraid." And Peter answered him and said, "Lord, if it is you, command me to come to you on the water." And he said, "Come." And when Peter had come down out of the boat, he walked on the water to go to Jesus. But when he saw that the wind was boisterous, he was afraid. And beginning to sink, he cried out, saying, "Lord, save me." And immediately Jesus stretched out his hand and caught him and said to him, "O you of little faith, why did you doubt?" And when they got into the boat, the wind ceased. And those who were in the boat came and worshipped him, saying, "Truly, you are the Son of God." Today's message is entitled "A King to Worship." There's a lot of things that in our relationship to Jesus, there are a lot of components that are important. Our relationship would be much weaker, much cheaper if we didn't have some appreciation of all of these components. There's a lot of things between us and Jesus. Probably one of the headliners there is worship. We have a king who's worthy of worship. We have a king who deserves our worship. We have a king who not only just deserves it categorically, but earns it all the time in how he acts toward us, how he cares for us, how he is attentive to us, and how he demonstrates his glory before us. Like, there's really no way to forget that he's worthy of worship. That we don't just worship him because we are compelled to, but we worship him because it's the only sensible thing to do, right? That's the only sensible way to respond to Jesus is in worship. And that entails many other things: obedience, our love for Jesus, our obedience to his commands. It entails a lot of things that are then also, incumbent on us because we worship him. Worship includes a lot of other things. But today, it's what we'd like to focus on here is acts of worship between us and Jesus, how we can worship him better because he is a king worth worshiping, and how he demonstrates that fact. This is a king to worship, and so how will we respond? The first point I'd like to make here is from, obviously, the first couple of verses of this passage, verses 22 to 24. Immediately, work's done. It's just fed 5,000 people, and the hour was already late. So immediately Jesus made his disciples get into the boat, go before him to the other side, while he sent the multitudes away. You've seen this happen before, all right? My wife gets a free membership at the gym for cleaning it. And so sometimes she scoots pretty quickly here so that we can have our afternoon, our evening together if she goes and gets the place clean. While I'm here for a while, to talk and to take care of things, and sometimes it's my turn to make sure the lights and doors are taken care of, and so go into the boat while he sends the multitudes away. Because, like Jesus here with the multitude, you can't just always just up and leave. Sometimes there's a lot of social interaction that has to take place in order to leave properly. And so Jesus is sending the multitudes away, and who knows how many people he's healing in the process and every other thing that they're always, depending on for him. So if you ever wondered, why does he send them out on the boat? For one thing, it's probably just normal. Hey, you guys get heading home. I'm going to handle the multitude here for a while, and then I'll follow you. Secondly, does he not know what he's going to do? Like, that's always a subplot in the Gospels. Is Jesus already knowing what's going to come of this, And so he sends them in the boat, start rowing. I'm going to be here with the multitude for a little while, and I'll meet you afterward. And you always wonder where they thought they were going to see him next. Because it ain't like what they thought. Is he going to borrow somebody else's boat? How is he going to just show up? But he sends them ahead to cross the sea. If you've ever seen the Sea of Galilee, it's pictures of the Sea of Galilee. It's decent size. and they're going to cross the lake. How is he just going to meet them? You know, it could be a couple days of traveling and working miracles, because Jesus, you don't move too fast in a crowd. You know, and everywhere Jesus goes, there's a crowd. So it's going to take him a while to meet them if he walks around. Like, you always wonder what's going through their minds. You know, what is Jesus, what's he up to, you know, this time? He sent the multitudes away. And when he had sent the multitudes away, he went up on the mountain by himself to pray. He's letting them get pretty far out in the boat, yes? Like, he's letting them get pretty far from shore. And now when evening came, he was alone there. But the boat was now in the middle of the sea and tossed by the waves, for the wind was contrary. I really appreciated what John shared this morning. That is definitely something that we often have to take stock of. We have to, you know, figure out what our motivations are and what our interpretations are. Like, are we trying to do good things for God so that we'll get good things back from him? Like, that's not really a good motivation, you know. And on the other hand, when we get good things or bad things in our life, how often do we try and weigh the cause and effect? Like, what did I do that made God do this? You know, what did I do that earned this? You know, and it's true that that's something that, you know, we have to deal with pretty often, because as John said, it's human nature for us to evaluate our relationship to God on the basis of how we are relating to him, and forgetting that ultimately it's how he, based on his own character, relates to us, because he's 100% consistent. And so he sent them away. Now, as we already read, he has the capacity to, I mean, I know it sounds bizarre, but that's why you come to Jesus, because he has bizarre capacities. He can do things like forgive sin. It's nuts, you know? If he was normal, you wouldn't need him, all right? You're already you, all right? So he controls the weather in this story. I know that's bizarre, but that's the point. So he lets them get pretty, he puts them in the boat, goes up on the mountain to pray, and lets them get way out in the middle of the Sea of Galilee, which they were probably making pretty good headway, because you remember at least four of his disciples are professionals, right? This is home turf, right? They make their living on the Sea of Galilee. They do nothing but sit in boats, right? This is constant for them. So they're probably making pretty good time. They know how to do what they're doing. He lets them get pretty far out in the sea, gets them in the boat, gets them pretty far out in the sea, and he allows the weather to do what it does here in the story, all right? He has the capacity to make that not happen. He is, after all, the one that stills the storm at the end of the story. So why did he let it start in the first place? Jesus, and this is what John was saying, does not necessarily put you in the boat for a pleasure cruise. Jesus does not necessarily put you in the boat because it's a pleasure cruise. He puts you in the boat for a lot of other reasons that are way bigger and way more important. Right? Jesus has bigger priorities than what you do. Right? That's why we need him. Because once again, if he were just normal, if he saw life the same way we saw life, and if he shared our priorities, we wouldn't really much need him. Right? What good would it do? Rather, we are learning to share his priorities, and sometimes to bring about that change, fundamental change in our perspectives, he puts us in a boat that is not going the direction we want it to go, and not going under the conditions that we want to travel, right? But we're going in the direction that he wants to travel, and for us to see that he's the one driving this flying circus called life, the boat rocks, right? This is not necessarily a pleasure cruise, because in the end, the things you go through are the things you grow through. And I like saying that because it rhymes, it's easy to remember, and if you can make something that rhymes, it's assumed to be true. You know? But it is true. The things that you go through are the things that you grow through. And so Jesus puts you through things because you need them. All right? You need him, and you need his guidance in these things that you will go through. We can create like endless amounts of trouble for ourselves, and most of us have. But when Jesus produces trouble in your life, it's for a purpose. We produce pointless problems for ourselves and for others, mostly by not listening to Jesus. If you listen to Jesus, you will still have trouble, but it is trouble with a specific point. It is trouble that is an opportunity for growth. They say that which does not kill you makes you stronger. This is not necessarily true, right? You can have plenty of things that do not kill you, but they do make you much, much weaker, right? How many things have you gone through that have not destroyed you, but they have at least temporarily weakened you, They have weakened you, and it took a long time to become strong again, right? So here's an easy one. Does the flu make you stronger? It generally does not kill you. It also does not make you stronger. It's not like at the other end of having the flu, you're stronger than you were before. No, it takes a couple days of actually being able to eat and drink to get back to where you were beforehand. The flu does not make you stronger. There's sin in the world. Not everything in the world is totally good. You know, not everything in the world has a good effect. All right, so that's just an easy example because, I mean, who hasn't had the flu, right? So that's what, you know, sometimes you got to put something out there that's like, the illustration seems dumb, but it's because it's like all of us have had it happen. You know, we've all been sick, and you've all gotten sick. Did it make you stronger? No, it had the opposite effect, but because the body, you know, is incredible in the way that it heals itself, you regained strength, but you were not stronger because of the flu, right? It did not kill you, but it did not make you stronger. We can create problems for ourselves that may not kill us, but they weaken us. Because they are not good things. And it is only until the spirit is healed that we are made stronger. And we are not stronger because of the things that were self-inflicted. Right? Those things have only protracted the amount of time it takes us to become strong. Right? We've inflicted ourselves with spiritual illnesses. They do not make us stronger. Right? When Jesus brings something difficult into your life, it is by design and it will make you stronger if you are willing. Right? We subject ourselves to his leadership. We get in the boat. because when he has the authority to bring about situations in our life that are difficult because he has a bigger picture in mind and he has a better plan. So we need to, despite the difficulty of the circumstances that may arise when we follow his instructions to get in the boat, because we know it may not be a pleasure cruise. You get in the boat anyway. You embrace his authority anyway. Because he is a king worthy of worship, one of the things that we do because he is the king and because we want to worship him, one of our acts of worship is to embrace his kingly authority. Right? We worship him better when we embrace his authority, even in the full and plenary knowledge that he will bring difficult things into our life. You're going to have difficult things anyway. But if you reject his authority rather than embracing it, you will create your own difficult things. Right? And they will not make you stronger. He has the authority to bring difficult things in your life. He has that right. And he also has the wisdom to bring into your life difficult things that will make you stronger as long as you are open to it. As long as you are open to being changed, he will change you, and he will change you for the better. God cannot be tempted with evil, neither tempts anyone. And so the difficult things that he brings into your life are not designed as a temptation to doubt him, right? They are designed as an opportunity to strengthen your relationship of trust with him and to strengthen you in many other ways as well, depending on what those circumstances are. So we embrace his authority as an act of worship because we know that he has that authority and that he is a king worth worshiping. Now in the fourth watch of the night, Jesus went to them walking on the sea, and the disciples saw him walking on the sea, and they were troubled, saying, "It's a ghost," and they cried out for fear. But immediately Jesus spoke to them, saying, "Be of good cheer, it is I, do not be afraid." So, you know, again, some of these guys are pretty tough, and they've been on this sea their whole lives, all right? Some of them, we know they're at least second generation, right? James and John, the sons of Zebedee, they left Zebedee, their father, and the hired men with the boats, and followed Jesus. All right, so this has been in the family. Like, these people have been on this water a lot, okay? But this is probably the first time they've seen somebody doing this, all right? He is walking on the water, and they say, "It's a ghost!" Like, that's the most ridiculous thing to say. But they've been on this water for decades and have never seen something like this. And so disbelief has been, like, suspended. You know, they're trying to come up with some explanation for something that they have never seen, and now they're afraid of ghosts. Some of these guys are pretty rugged guys. One of them is we don't ever know if he what he's involved in, but he is part of a group, right? Simon the Zealot. He's part of a group that plan political assassinations, or at least that's part of their theory. Like, that's what they want to do. We don't know what he is involved in, but that's the, I mean, some of these guys are pretty rough, all right? There are people who assign themselves to that group who are political assassins. Simon the Zealot is part of that group or considers himself part of that group, but you don't really know what his level of involvement is before he meets Jesus. But the point I'm making here is that there are some tough guys, and now they're afraid of ghosts. Like, what in the world? Well, I've never seen anybody walking on water, and I don't totally know how I would respond. particularly since under the circumstances they are already having great trouble, right? The wind is already contrary. You're going to have contrary winds in your life, yes? Like, you're going to have things where circumstances seem like they're conspiring against you, and then when something else, you know, Jesus is here walking on the water in the middle of all this, when something else appears, you may not respond in a way that seems totally rational if someone were to write it down. Right. So I took Sterling camping for the first time this summer, and it was so hilarious. A lot of you have already heard this story, but you ever heard porcupines? Okay, if you've never heard porcupines, you need to Google it. Okay, look, I know some of you have heard porcupines because I told you this story and I Googled it for you. Have you ever heard a porcupine? All right. So I'm not going to imitate it because this is going on the internet, and I already say do ridiculous things once in a while, but you need to Google it. Okay, it sounds like, I don't know, I heard it described as like a rabid Ewok, and that's pretty close, all right? Like, it's weird, all right? And you just about believe in ghosts, all right? Like, it's dark. The kid sleeps through the whole thing, but you hear this rustling because, of course, they're fat and covered with hollow quills, so they drag in the leaves everywhere they go. You hear this rustling in the leaves, and then you hear this the sound that they make. Right, and they only ever make that sound when there's two of them, and they actually have a few different reasons that they make these unearthly sounds. So they're answering each other. All right, there's two of them scratching around and answering each other, and it is the eeriest, like it is the weirdest sound. Okay, how many of you heard coyotes at night before? Okay, it's weirder. All right, maybe not spookier, but weirder. Right, it is a weird sound, and they're answering each other, and you're tempted to respond immaturely, like to take the kid and the tent with you without ever even getting out of the bag. I mean, just poof, you know. And I laid there, and I'm like, I look at him, and he's sound asleep. I'm like, if he wakes up to this, there will be no consoling him. You know, he didn't. He never did. He never woke up. The whole time he woke up, he's like, man, that was great. And I'm like, huh? Just like at home, it seems like you were the two that ever have a good night's sleep. You know. And my goodness, it's raucous and eerie. And you're tempted to believe in ghosts, you know. When you are in a certain situation in life, whatever your situation is, you see things from that perspective. They are already afraid, all right? So fear is already in their minds. And I'm not going to go down one of my favorite rabbit trails about telling you how fear is sin. We're not going to get into that today. But just in this situation, they are fearful. They're afraid for their lives because they're in the middle of a storm, you know. Now, and then Jesus appears. So with a certain mindset that they're already in, and you have a perspective too, right? In your circumstances, you already have a perspective. And so in that perspective, if something were to come around in your life that were like really out of the ordinary, all right, how would you respond? Well, you're already foundationally seeing your circumstances a certain way. Like say you're in a real crisis and you're feeling a little bit desperate, and I don't know. Maybe you are. And then something else happens. You're going to respond in desperation because that's already your frame of mind. They are already afraid. They respond in fear. It's a ghost. And Jesus says, it is be of good cheer. He hasn't even told them it's him yet. He says, be of good cheer. Then he says, it is I. Do not be afraid. Folks, Jesus doesn't necessarily accept our normal response to the situation. We, being sinners, can have a normal, typical response and be wrong. Right? Jesus doesn't necessarily accept our normal response to the situation. Sometimes, he requires a response that is supernatural. He requires us to learn to think like him, or we will never get out of this situation and be stronger. So in worship, if we've accepted his authority to bring situations into our life, then we also have to accept his authority to tell us how to think about those situations. We need to learn to respond supernaturally to the things that he brings about in our life. That is the reason he brings them about. He wants us to be more like him and think more like him, and being more like him requires thinking more like him. And so that it's that supernatural response. It's like, how would Jesus want me to think about this situation? That is really what is required of us. We need to learn to think and respond to our situations in a supernatural way. Right? We are putting aside fleshly, normal thinking and letting the mind of Jesus be in us. Right? Now, here's for instance, that passage that says, let the mind of Christ be in you, which was also in Christ Jesus, talks about one of the most supernatural reactions we ever have, and that is humility. right? That's the specific context of that. So, you know, we are always in the process of having our minds renewed and training them to be like the mind of Jesus and think like Jesus and see our situations like Jesus wants us to, right? And humility is only one example. I mean, try that one alone on for size just this week, right? Make it 7 days of being humble. If you do, you have the right not to be humble anymore because you can brag about that, right? 7 days of humility, like, I dare you, you know? So we need to be, we're always constantly learning or should be learning to respond supernaturally to the circumstances that Jesus has on his authority brought into our life. We need to embrace his authority to bring situations that will change us into our life. And then we need also to learn how to think supernaturally. We need to respond to our circumstances supernaturally. And this is just one example where he says here, you know, they're afraid and he says, don't be afraid. And then he gives them a reason why. Be of good cheer. Take courage. Oh, because it's me, so don't be afraid. You know, and so that's one example. You know, we need to be able to set fear aside if we actually believe that Jesus is running the show. We need to set. You know, we need to develop humility. Again, as another example, we need to develop humility. That's not a supernatural response to our circumstances when someone has given us grief. You know, humility is not a normal response. And there are lots of abnormal responses, and you can see them just by watching Jesus in the Gospels. It's like everything he does is not normal, you know, but it is normative. It is the way, it is the rule, and we are either complying with the rule of life seen in Jesus or we are not. And so we need to learn to, and that's why he brings these situations into our life. So embrace his authority and learn to respond supernaturally. This is a fascinating I think the story kind of turns another corner here in these next three verses. Peter answered him and said, Lord, if it's you, command me to come on to you on the water. And so he said, come. And when Peter had come out of the boat, he walked up. He saw that the wind was boisterous. He was afraid. And beginning to sink, he cried out, saying, Lord, save me. And immediately Jesus stretched out his hand. And we'll get to that in a minute. So Peter says, if it is you, first class condition, if then. If it is you, then command me to come out of the boat. And Jesus says, come. Which means that come was not an invitation. Peter did not ask for an invitation. He asked for a command. If it's you, command me. Because if it is you, you have the right to command me. So if it's you, command me. You know, urge me to step out of this boat if it's really you. And so when Jesus says, come, it's an imperative. If we open ourselves up to his authority, he may in fact take you from the frying pan to the fire. All right. In this case, he goes from a wave. Peter goes from a wave-tossed boat to the waves themselves. Peter is nuts. All right. We can see that in the Gospels. We can see it in Acts, and we can see it by the ways he is responding to his closing years as we read 1 and 2 Peter. Peter is nuts. That's why I like him. My sister has a shirt. Of course, a lot of you in youth group have seen it. It says, "Normal people scare me." Right? I think that's excellent. I would add they also usually bore me. Right? There, Jesus is not normal. Peter is not normal. This is not normalcy, is not what we're striving after. We're striving after a supernatural life, a life that's really worth living. And there are not more than probably three people in the world that I would change places with, because there's really only a few people in the world that I think have a life that I envy. Right? What is normal for us, what is acceptable for us, is usually, in fact, pretty lame by comparison to the apostles, right? I don't envy very many people's course of life, even though, I mean, maybe it's been good and I'm glad for you, but I don't really necessarily envy it, all right? I envy people like Peter. I mean, not the part where he's crucified upside down, just everything up to that. The man's incredible, but we have to accept the fact that that may be the natural end of someone who has as incredible a devoted life as Peter does. And so we just have to weigh those things in our mind. What's it worth? What's it worth to have a life that's really worth envying? You know, a life that's really worth writing down. Peter's life gets written down. There was this old Navy recruiting ad that said, if anyone wrote a book about your life, would anyone bother to read it? That's a good question. Peter's life is actually worth reading about. You know, and it's because he's nuts. It's like, if that's really you, like, I don't think that's what I would have said. All right, Jesus, if it's you, prove it by hovering an additional 6 inches above the water. I mean, that would have been a good test. But no, he says, if it's really you, make me walk on water. You got to be crazy, man. It's like, so how many of you do not believe in telekinesis? Raise your hand. All right, how many of you do believe in telekinesis? Raise my hand. You know, Peter's like, if that's really you, have me walk on water. You got to be crazy. Well, Peter is crazy. Just read the book. I mean, the guy is crazy. That's why he's interesting, right? That's why he's worth reading about. He has a life that's worth writing down, you know, because he's nuts. And he knows, like, what he's nuts over. And frankly, like all the really interesting people I know, he's nuts over Jesus. If it's you, command me to come to you on the water. I want to be with you. In this storm, you're obviously hacking it, so I want to be where you are. And Jesus says, come. If we actually open ourselves up to God's leading, we may get commands that are more than what we bargained for. But more than what you bargained for is exactly what you're bargaining for. That's what you get as part of the deal. Jesus is more than you can handle, and he will put you in situations that are more than you can handle. Peter does, after all, start to sink. The circumstances here are more than Peter can handle. But the dude gets out of the boat. And we can talk about how he lost sight of Jesus, and it is one of the key lessons of this passage. How he lost sight of Jesus, he saw the waves were boisterous, and so he started to sink. All right? Before he lost sight of Jesus, the dude was walking on water. But let's bear in mind that the only reason he's sinking in the water is because he got out of the boat. And how many of us are really willing, if we saw Jesus, if you saw Jesus walking across Lake Bonin today, would you say, if that's really you, I want to come out there? You going to take a step? Are you going to take a step? Are you going to walk out on that water to meet Jesus? I dare say most of us ain't, right? Because we're not accustomed to living that closely with Jesus where we genuinely believe he can bring about things that are that radical, right? We don't believe it because we're not accustomed to living that closely to him. Peter's gotten pretty used to Jesus. He just saw Jesus feed 5,000 people a couple of hours ago. All right? And if we're not as keenly aware as Peter of what greater things Jesus can do in us, it may be because we haven't seen him do great enough things. We haven't been close enough to him to see the miracles that he does, and so we can't expect him to do any miracles through us. Well, get close to Jesus and see what he does do, and then you'll believe he can do it with you too. Because all the people he does great things with are basically people like you. And that's what I love about the apostles. These guys they're pretty normal people, right? There's a couple of professionals. There's, again, a political rebel. There's a tax collector that nobody likes. And there's four guys that are commercial fishermen. I mean, it's really just pretty much everybody. And Jesus was a carpenter, you know? A carpenter in half his hometown didn't really believe this whole virgin birth business. You know, like he's not always seen in the best light, or his parents aren't always seen in the best light. Like, these are pretty normal lives. It's just that one of them happens to be God in the flesh. And so he does abnormal things with normal people. That's the only thing he's got to work with, because we're all just normal people. And which is why I really dislike people who enjoy being popular. Like, I do not like people who like being the center of attention. Jesus is the center of attention. Like, it's another reason I don't mind sitting down when I preach. Because I think it gives a totally different picture of how I see this relationship, and also because you can see the cross better. And it's really hard for me to like people who like being the center of attention, because I think it's gross. And these are just, you know, so I like normal people. And you look at the apostles, and they're just normal people who happen to be close to God. And Peter has never walked on water before this point. In the, we'll say, 30 years he's been on the sea, he has never walked on water. But he is willing to expect that Jesus can do something greater with him than what he himself has ever previously experienced. The dude gets out of the boat. And because Jesus will sometimes take us from the boat to the waves themselves, we need to expect greater things tomorrow than yesterday. Otherwise, we are rejecting... Like, we are not believing in his capabilities. Right? We are saying, Jesus, you are not capable of making me a greater Christian than I was yesterday. You cannot use me in better ways than what you did yesterday because I'm not good enough. That is not the point. It is him you are saying is not good enough, and you are using yourself as an excuse. Excuses are lies that only you believe. And you can't use your limitations as an excuse, because Jesus doesn't believe in your limitations. He's unlimited, and if you're talking about your limitations, the problem is who you're talking about. Don't talk to Jesus about yourself. Allow him to talk to you about him. And allow him to talk to you about yourself, right? He's got a lot of things in you to change. And when he does, greater things will happen tomorrow than they did yesterday. So we need to expect them. Or we are thinking too little of Jesus and his capacity. And immediately Jesus stretched out his hand and caught him and said to him, "You have little faith, why did you doubt?" And when they got into the boat, the wind ceased. And then those who were in the boat came and worshipped him, saying, "Truly you are the Son of God." Jesus sometimes responds, I got to say sometimes, all right? But Jesus sometimes responds as quickly as we are willing to cry out. Peter probably did not need to be sinking very long before he cried out to Jesus, "How long you been sinking? Are you willing to cry out yet?" Yeah, you know those ant lions? It's actually the larva of something else, I forget what. But they dig a hole in the sand, a funnel-shaped hole in the sand, and so when ants come along, they fall down it, right? Because the sand is kind of loose because the ant lion has just dug it up. The sand is loose, the ant falls in it, and the more they struggle to get out, the more they dig themselves into the hole. And then the ant lion eats them. Right there, your adversary, the devil, is a roaring lion walking about seeking whom he may devour. How long are you going to just stand there and struggle in the hole he dug for you? How soon are you going to call out? How long have you been struggling? How long have you been sinking? It doesn't take Peter under these circumstances very long. I mean, he's sinking in a stormy sea of Galilee. He's going to die. It doesn't take him very long to cry out. I don't think we often recognize that in our from our human perspective and in our own limited strength, we don't often recognize that we are just digging ourselves into a worse hole. Like, we don't recognize that our situation is as bad as it really is. And so we continue to keep working our way out, making our problems worse. Right? We need to depend on things that are dependable, like Jesus. Right? He is dependable, and he will respond to you as quickly as you are willing to cry out. It does not mean, this is why I say sometimes, sometimes he will do that by changing your situation. He was only letting you be in that situation because you hadn't cried out. Sometimes he will ameliorate the situation as quickly as you are able as you are willing to cry out. After all, he just fed 5,000 people because the disciples finally asked him, "Hey, it's getting late. We need to send these people away so they can find something to eat." And when someone was willing to bring Jesus the problem, he works a miracle. Changes the whole dynamic of the situation. Sometimes he does that. But all the time, he will respond. As quickly as we are willing to cry out, he will respond. And not always in radically changing the situation, but sometimes in radically or even just incrementally changing you so that you can better manage the situation. It is, after all, why he put you in that situation. And if it is a situation that we have created ourselves, that will not make us stronger, I think he will very often lead you out of it more quickly. Because it's not a situation he wants you to be in. Yes, you're still going to have to deal with the consequences. It's cause and effect universe, people. Everything we do has consequences. But he will get you out of a situation where it is your own sin or stupidity that's gotten you into it. He will help you out of that one real quick because it's not where he wants you to be. And he will respond to us as immediately as we are willing to call out. I was talking to Jim Histan this week and about this kind of the same thing. And he's like, it is unbelievable. And this is coming from a guy who is as physically large and technically capable as Jim Histan is. He's saying it's unbelievable like how often we try to do things in our own capacity. And then at the end of our rope, we find out that he was just waiting for us to call on him all along. Folks, that is true day after day that we continue to do things our own way. Peter gets out of the boat. At some point here, he does lose sight of Jesus, and it's the circumstances that capture his attention. As always, when the circumstances take your eyes off Jesus, you will sink. Peter, because he recognizes the disastrous nature of his situation, calls out quickly, and immediately Jesus reached out his hand. Jesus is trying to teach Peter a lesson and the rest of the disciples a lesson. He's trying to show the magnificence and the glory of God. He's not trying to, scare Peter. Peter asked to come out there. All right, he's not going to let Peter sink till he's right about here, just for suspense. All right, Jesus is there to help him. He invites him out of the boat at Peter's request that he be commanded. If that's you, command me to come out, and Jesus does. And then when Peter's in trouble in following him, all right, Peter is getting into trouble in the act of following Jesus, and Jesus immediately responds. We get into all kinds of trouble, even in the act of trying to follow Jesus. Like, we could do things with the best motivations and still just do them wrong. Raise your hand, But in those circumstances, he is very quick to help us do it better. When we're following him, he's not trying to trick us or fool us or make a fool out of us. He is there proving himself dependable, and he will respond as immediately as we are willing to call out. And the last point I want to make is just this question. If we embrace his authority, we learn to respond to the situations that he authoritatively brings us into, we learn to respond to him in a supernatural way. We expect that that is to change us so that we will be greater people and we can expect greater things in our relationship with Jesus tomorrow. And we know that because we can depend on him. Now, is that a king worth worshiping? You cannot possibly be ambivalent, all right? It is either a king worth worshiping or a fantasy you don't believe in. Either I am not telling you the truth or we have a king worth worshiping. Jesus doesn't leave us a lot of middle ground, which is why I sometimes say as radical, you know, bipolar things as I do, all right? Because there really isn't a lot of middle ground with Jesus, and that's how I want you to see him, all right? There is not a lot of middle ground with Jesus. Either I am just making stuff up, or Jesus is a king worth worship. And I don't know how many of you in here today have got to make that decision for yourself, but you better get on it, right? Because Jesus is a king worth worshiping. And there's going to come a day when every knee will bow and every tongue will confess that Jesus is God to the glory of God the Father. And every tongue, all right? Those who are proclaiming it gladly and those who are proclaiming it as an act of surrender, they've finally been defeated, right? You get to pick which group you're going to be part of, all right? Is it in shame, agony, and defeat, or is it in glory and joy to finally be in his fullness of his presence that you will say that Christ is king? Because you're going to say it, right? And again, either that is a fantasy you don't have to bother believing, or it's a decision you have to make for yourself, right? And those of us who know him, are we worshiping him today? The disciples, they fell down and worshiped him, saying, "You are the Son of God." They already knew Jesus, right? But it's something that the people who know him have the most right and the most joy in doing, is worshiping a king that's worth worshiping. Embracing his authority, responding supernaturally, expecting greater things from him, and depending on him first. I would like you to meet, that's the end of the message. I just want to put out an invitation for you right now. I would like you to meet someone that's been very special to me for a long time. Some of you have known her also. This is one of those people that has made a decision, like Peter, to get out of the boat. This is, sometimes you can become accustomed to something long enough that you kind of lose sight of it. We do that a lot. I'd like to remind you that this Saturday is National Public Lands Day. So go hike Mount Pisgah. Don't lose sight of the things that you lose sight of because they're just close by. It's one of the incredible gifts of being an American. I would urge you this Saturday to take advantage of it. But this person, Penny Warner, has been someone you know close to our family for a long time. She graduated from Sierra High School right between the year between two of my uncles. Known her family for a long time. Her father, after he passed away, my grandfather kind of retrospectively said, "You know, I think Liam was my best friend." You know, like we've known her family for a long time, and some of you have known her for a long time too. Donnie and Debbie aren't here this morning. They've known Penny for a long time. Seth and Sarah have known Penny for a long time. Margaret, any of you who are here at church here in the 80s and 90s, you've known Penny for a long time. She's, of course, our missionary to Senegal. Some of you have never met the woman, all right? Some of you have met her only briefly and only recently. She has been working in Senegal, West Africa for 30-some years and working in translation, working in the bush. I mean, out there, okay? She is one of those people that has made a decision that Jesus is either worth following radically or you might as well just believe in the deity of fried eggs. You know, that it's an all-or-nothing proposition with Jesus. And the 13th of October, Sunday evening, she's going to be here because we are reaching the end of her mission career, but she's been there for 30-some years. She doesn't have 30-some years to go, all right? We're going to take an opportunity that I've thought somebody should do for a long time, and eventually you kind of realize you're a big boy, and so if there's something you think somebody ought to do, you better just do it, you know? She's going to give her normal update presentation of where she's at with her ministry, and then we're going to sit down. And we're going to have a conversation with Penny that I hope lasts a good long time. I want you to get to know her, those of you who haven't known her that long, and those of us who have, I want us to see kind of with fresh eyes what it really means to follow Jesus as radically as she has, and in fact, her sister and brother-in-law and their son. Like, it's like a family trait to be a radical Christian. And I want you to get to know this lady. Even those of us who have known her, I think, will enjoy it the most because she's been special to us for a long time. You'll get to see her truck looks about like Silas's. Like, this lady is not normal. This lady is a radical, and some of you that haven't known her, you need to get to know her. And some of you that have known her, of course, we're going to enjoy the evening because you can't not enjoy being around Penny. Fabulous person, totally devoted to Jesus, very, very humble about what she does and about the role that she's had. She has saved lives, and on the way, you know, spending a life in the bush trying to save souls, she's saved lives too. I mean, she's the only ride to the hospital, and it's not close. You know, I mean, imagine riding a couple hours through the bush in Silas's truck to get to the hospital, you know? But hey, when you're desperate, right? So I hope you all can be here for that. It's going to be a great evening. I scheduled it for October because we will roast up here if we did it now. So it's going to be in October so we can sit here comfortably, we can take our time, and so that'll be at 6:30 at kind of our normal evening service time, you know, all of our evening events. That'll be at 6:30 here on the 13th. I hope you can make it. It's going to be a really special time, and it's one of those things that probably she doesn't have a lot of years left to do this, all right? And so it's, for me, it's a huge opportunity. And as I was telling Silas last week after the hymn sing, he was there and Penny was there, and I was like, do you know her? You need to get to know her, you know? For me personally, I think it'll be great for our relationship because it's an opportunity for you to see how I see Christianity, right? To talk to, because she's one of those people that has been very influential on me and how I think. She is one of those few people that, as I said earlier, there's a few people in the world I would actually change places with. Not because she's had a comfortable life, all right? Because it's been exactly the opposite of comfortable. She's had, by many measures, a terrible life, and it's been awesome. You got to decide what Jesus is worth. If someone wrote her story, I'd read it. And so that's what we're going to do here. We're going to take an hour or two or whatever, as long as you want to be here. And we are going to, in a sense, write Penny's biography together. We're going to enjoy that time with her, and I think it's going to be really beneficial. She is one of those people that to whom Christianity is no joke, right? So you need to be here for that. It's going to be awesome. Let's go ahead and close in prayer with that in mind. Father in heaven, we thank you for your authority to command us and direct us, and we thank you that when we follow you, that the life we are living with you becomes something we would have never expected. And we thank you for doing unexpected things because we expect too little. We're afraid of success. We're afraid of who we might become. We are afraid of what you might do with us or call us to do. We're afraid of seeing just a little bit too much change in us. So we pray, Lord, that you would break down those foolish, ridiculous barriers in our minds, that you would make us thirst for a closer walk with you, that you would make us relish the danger of living in sight of reality. And we pray that you would help us to love and appreciate your word and your people and your church around the world. We pray that we would understand that when we are Christians first. We thank you for loving us. We thank you for teaching us how to love you back. In Jesus' name, amen. If you'll stand and join us again, please.